Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, guys. Welcome to the show. Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs, download a title free, and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese. All right, let's get you to it. Hello, I'm Jesse McAnally.
And I'm Andrew DeWolf.
And welcome to Musicals with Cheese, a podcast where I try to get Andrew to like musical theater. And this week we have an extra special guest. You'll know her from Maven of the Eventide, Vampire Reviews, and a dozen other things. It is Elisa.
Hello. Yes. A dozen other things. I don't know about
another,
a dozen.
A couple other things. You're an author, and I've seen you a bunch of other places, both within your like wheelhouse, and like you've cameoed all over the place. So you're well known.
My main thing is a web show on YouTube about vampires, where I talk about the social allegories that vampires represent in media and all the different ways they can be presented and whether they're done well or not. Because let's face it, most vampire things are not done well. But I'm also an author. My first book just came out last week, and I don't know when this podcast is actually going to air, so it may not be last week anymore, but it did just come out, and I'm very excited. It's called The Company of Death, and yes, it does have vampires in it.
Hey, you know your niche. You know your niche.
It's got to have vampires.
I'm also formerly a musical theater major in college. That's what my degree is in, even though now I work on YouTube, but I got a musical background.
A specific background in this musical. What are we covering today, Elisa?
One of my favorites, The Phantom of the Opera by Andrew Lloyd Webber, not to be confused with the dozen other Phantom musicals out there.
Elisa, you probably know a grand deal about the behind the scenes and turmoil of Phantom of the Opera. So let's start all the way back in the Gaston LaRue days. Let's talk about where the book came from and how that was inspired, because I know that's a long storied past.
Well, Gaston LaRue was a reporter back in France in the oldie times, late 1800s, early 1900s. But he was also an author and he wrote detective stories because, you know, he's a reporter. And he wrote Phantom of the Opera originally as a serial for a newspaper, and then it was compiled in 1910 into a book and then translated into English in 1911. And the English translation that was translated in 1911, which is abridged and not full, but it's public domain. So anybody can use that English translation and make their own version of Phantom, and many, many people have.
And that's not limited to Lon Chaney and more recent productions by Ryan Bijan and tons of stuff. Really, everyone has touched this.
Interestingly, the original French version of Phantom is still under copyright, so you cannot adapt the French Phantom or the full version of Phantom, only that one abridged English translation.
What does the French version have that the English version doesn't, that we like won't specifically be able to adapt?
Just a few little scenes, a few conversations. It starts out kind of the same, and then as it gets towards the end, it feels like the translator was rushing, so he started cutting out more and more as he went.
Okay, so it's not like the MGM Wizard of Oz thing, where you can't get the certain shade of the witch's green color and the ruby slippers or anything like that. but then, like, what do you think is the most notorious adaptation of the Phantom of the Opera that isn't the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical?
Well, most well known would be the silent film, Lon Chaney, 1925. It's Universal Pictures, and it was 1925 originally, but then it was kind of reissued in 1929 with a different cut. So there's two versions out there. And it was one of Universal's last big monster movies before they switched to talkies. So Universal has this pantheon of monster movies like Dracula and the Creature from the Black Lagoon and the Mummy and the Wolfman and all of that. And Phantom is the only one that's part of that that is really a silent film. So it often kind of gets left behind, which makes me sad because the Phantom is the best.
We'll never get that Dark Universe Phantom of the
I
opera.
Know. Because the Dark Universe is dead, supposedly.
I don't know. Blumhouse is doing the Invisible
tier.
Man.
Yeah, I think that's the real reason, but...
Yeah, but it's not Dark Universe Invisible Man. It's just a Invisible mm-hmm. Man. But it's
oh,
not going to be Johnny
God for
Depp.
That.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp should
no.
play the Phantom.
I prefer Tommy Wiseau. He wouldn't even need makeup.
Tommy Wiseau. Oh, good God.
Now, let's talk about how Andrew Lloyd Webber became involved with the Phantom of the Opera. Because really, he kind of stole the idea from another musical, didn't he?
Kind of, but it wasn't really his fault. So Andrew Lloyd Webber was a composer of musical theater who wished he was a rock star or a rock music composer. Like, he has these rock and roll roots that he just wants to go to and has never really quite done, but he does do rock musicals. So he'd done Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and Jesus Christ Superstar and all of those. But he really wanted to do a romantic musical. And he'd been wanting to do something romantic for a long time, especially after he fell in love with Sarah Brightman. She was in Cats. She was like one of the random dancing cats that doesn't get to sing. And I don't know if that's where they met, but that's kind of where they got involved. And they fell in love and got married. And she got a part in a different Phantom musical by Ken Hill in England. And the interesting thing about the Ken Hill musical is that it uses real opera songs and kind of rewrites the lyrics. So it's not a musical. It's like a jukebox musical of opera songs. So she was involved in that. And Andrew Lloyd Webber was like, well, my wife is in this. I've always wanted to do something romantic. I keep doing all these rock and roll things, but I really want to do something romantic. I'm going to take over this show and produce it and bring it to like the big time theaters in London. And he was all set to do that with his wife as the star. And then his buddies, Harold Prince and Cameron McIntosh, who are like big time producer director guys, were like, no, Andy, don't do that. Write your own. And he's like, nah, I'm not sure if I'm, I mean, it already exists with that. I don't know. And they're like, no. Trust us, write your own. You've been wanting to do this romantic thing for the longest time. Write your own. So he did. And that is why the Phantom musical is so different from the Phantom book, because he was really looking for this romance vehicle mm-hmm. for
and
his
I
wife
I also feel
to
like it's
in.
Really difficult to adapt the Phantom book because it is a mystery novel, and the Phantom of the Opera has become so ubiquitous in like culture that there's no way you can have it be a mystery.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the book is very noir. Gaston Leroux wrote, like, locked room mystery kind of things. It's like, who could have done it? And when you read Phantom, it's not so much a murder mystery, like, who's the killer going to turn out to be? But it's you really don't know where it's going until all of a sudden, hey, there's this guy who lives in the basement and he's been killing people.
And then the musical started production and it went through all sorts of trials and tribulations, like Harold Prince being fired, replaced by Trevor Nunn, and then being rehired again. Richard Stilgo being invited to do the lyrics and then fired after they decided he was too campy and bringing on Charles Hart, who brought on the more romantic side of things like Think of Me and All I Ask of You.
Because it's not campy at all.
It is in the right way. Like, I honestly think Richard Stilgo's lyrics are my favorite lyrics in the musical.
Well, see, it's a mid-80s romantic musical, and if the 80s did anything, they went hard.
Agreed. the 80s are wonderful.
Like, you know, like Meatloaf videos, like that's what they were going for.
It was, but they, as Andrew says, like, we'll go into this later, but they only do it for one song, really. The musical opened in London's West End in 1986 and on Broadway in 1988. It starred Michael Crawford and, as mentioned before, Sarah Brightman. And with an estimated worldwide total gross receipts of over $5.6 billion and total Broadway gross of $845 million, Phantom was...
Is that just from ticket sales?
Just from ticket sales.
Because you know how they say that Star Wars got so big not from movie ticket sales, but from the merchandise? Phantom did the same thing. So if that's just from ticket sales, imagine the merchandise. It's that much more.
How many of those little half masks did they sell?
Like, this thing made so much money for so many people.
It's insane. And It, Wicked, and The Lion King are the only Broadway shows to ever cross $1 billion. It really is a landmark musical. And that's just the history and all that. We're not even talking about our own individual opinions on it. Like, there's no denying
it's
how big of a cultural landmark this is, both in the musical theater world and just as culture as a whole. No longer is it Gaston Leroux's Phantom of the Opera, and the first thing that we think of is Lon Chaney being unmasked. First thing we think about now is the designs by Maria Bjornsson and all that stuff, the choices that was made by Harold Prince. This is forever the Phantom of the Opera.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, you look at something like Dracula, you still think about Bela Lugosi. You don't think about Dracula the Musical by Frank Wildhorn. Nobody thinks about that. Back to Phantom.
Do you guys want to talk about the story? Not go, like, plot by plot element, but talk about, like, the general things of what happened and how we interpret it?
Let's do it.
All right, so the musical starts with a prologue, which is really weird, and made even weirder by the adaptation to film, which pays it off. But what do you guys think of that opening in 1911 Paris with Raoul and Meg Giry, or maybe Madame Giry? I'm not sure which one it's supposed to be.
I think it's supposed to be Madame Giry. Like, super old Madame Giry. But I don't hate it. I feel like you could cut it and not really lose anything, but it sets up the overture. And the overture needs a little bit of setup. It can't come out of nowhere.
Fair. It sets up the dark nature of this and shows, like, this isn't going to be campy, like, as Andrew Lloyd Webber described, like, everyone in the audience was expecting it to be camp because of Michael Crawford, and then they saw this and were like, oh, this is serious.
It's not going to be campy, but then they say Lot 666.
Maybe that wasn't as cliche back in the mid-80s.
No, I'm going to say that that's still pretty on the nose even for the 80s. I mean, it is a great setup for the chandelier being lifted up and all that. Like, that's cool, but still I'm like, oh, we have this backstory. Like, even back when they wrote this, they knew Christine was dead for some reason.
I mean, Raoul is also a whole lot older there, so maybe she lived a long, full life before dying, you know? But
I don't know. I've seen Love Never Dies.
Yeah. That was not in their heads when they wrote the prologue. The prologue is dark and creepy. And usually the auctioneer has a very creepy voice. So it's definitely setting the tone. Plot-wise, is pretty pointless. Other than to let us know that disaster is going to happen. And I guess that sets up a exciting expectation.
Something bad might happen, so get through this opening scene about Hannibal and all these opera people leaving.
Yeah, so then Hannibal. Andrew Lloyd Webber really likes doing pastiche. If you know, like, his earlier shows, like Joseph and stuff, there's, like, a song in this style, then a song in this style, then a song in this style. So for Phantom, he got to do pastiches of different opera styles. And Hannibal is the first one we see. It's a very grand opera. It's supposed to be kind of like a Verdi ripoff. But it's also entirely pointless to the plot.
I was kind of unsure if it was, like, meant to be a parody of opera or if it's actually just trying to be an opera song. Like, wasn't really...
It's
kind of goofy, so...
I mean, a lot of old opera was a little bit goofy, and I think that he wanted to have fun with that. Like, nowadays, people think of opera as this very highbrow thing. But back when it was the only form of entertainment, there were different levels of seriousness when it came to opera. And the Palais Garnier, where Phantom is set, was a very serious opera house, but it was still kind of like you would look down upon someone who worked at the opera, like they wouldn't be high society, they would be an entertainer. So there is going to be a level of silliness to it where you don't take it that seriously.
It was fun. I like this part, though.
I like everything with Carlotta. Carlotta is probably like one of the most underrated characters in this show, in my opinion. And depending on the actress, I've seen a couple actors play her. It's really an impressive, and you understand her. Like, yeah, I don't want stuff falling on me when I'm at work either.
It's funny. The show starts off with this dark, serious prologue and then goes immediately into comic relief.
All the comic relief on at once. The managers, Carlotta, Piangi, all of them at once got...
There is a lot of comic relief in this.
The drunk guys and the elephant.
It is all effective comic relief. Like, it doesn't break the world.
I mean, that's one thing this show has, is it really has balance. Like, it's dark and serious and grand, and that's probably a big part of why it's been so popular for so long, because people think that makes it important. So they're like, oh, Phantom, that's a serious show. You gotta see Phantom. But it's not boring. It's not too serious. It's also really funny a lot of the time, so it's entertaining.
And the funniest characters are Monsieur Fickman and André, who are the new managers of the Opera Populaire. And as soon as they walk in, basically everything falls apart, and the Phantom offers threats, and Carlotta leaves, and they're left without their prima donna. Oh, no.
What are they going to do? It's a good thing the Phantom has someone ready for them to replace Carlotta, because it's not like he orchestrated that at all. So even though he doesn't say, like, hey, put Christine in Carlotta's role, it has to be Christine's friends that are like, hey, Christine could sing it. Yeah, I've heard her sing. She's pretty good lately. She still gets
the
part.
Of course she does, for that one night, and everyone is relatively pleased with it. And she runs into one of the investors, who is actually the Vicomte Raoul de Chagny, who recognizes her as his childhood friend.
Can it be Christine? Brava! Brava! Long ago, it seems so long ago, how young and innocent we were. She may not remember me, but I remember.
Flowers. Yeah, and then Raoul's like, hey, good show. Let's go get dinner. And she's like, no, Raoul, I can't. I got this other boyfriend who's not really human. He's an angel, and he teaches me how to sing, and he's been doing so for months. And, you know, it's a whole long story, so I can't go to dinner with you, because he's like...
Also, he might be my father.
He might be my dad.
Yeah, so when Christine was a kid, her father would tell her this story about how the angel of music came to this other little girl and, like, gave her the gift of song, kind of like in Sleeping Beauty when the fairies give the baby the gift of song. So Christine thinks that her father from beyond the grave sent this angel to teach her how to sing.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I kind of feel for her mental health a little bit.
Well,
but,
it's more like I am angry about this man in a mirror, as Michael Jackson described, taking advantage of this girl's, like, sensitive, like, father-daughter relationship, which damages her so badly that we see even later when she goes to the graveyard.
You find out in the book that he didn't come to her and be like, hey, I'm an angel, you should worship me. He just started talking to her through the mirror, and she's like, okay, there's a creepy voice talking to me. Hey, are you that angel my father talked about? And he's like, sure. Yeah, let's go with that. And he just kind of rolled with it.
And I feel like that's probably what happened in this musical as well. Because as soon as Raoul's out of the room and Christine is changed, he starts berating her and gaslighting her, basically.
Yeah, he's like, no boyfriends! No boyfriends!
Calls him a slave of fashion.
How does the Phantom have full control of this freaking opera house? I don't get that.
He's a genius.
Well, he was one of the original architects of the opera house. And when he was building the opera house, he built a bunch of secret passages into it where he could get wherever he wanted, creep people out, steal things, and make them believe in ghosts. So now they're all terrified, thinking that if they don't do something, this actual supernatural ghost is going to hurt them. So, you know, reign of terror.
Was this explained? Did I miss this?
I don't remember it in the LaRue book, but I remember it very specifically in the Susan Kay novel.
Okay. It is in the LaRue book. It's all in the epilogue, so you've got to read all the way to the end and then, like, past the end.
Okay. So I didn't just miss this. Okay, so I'm not just dumb.
There is a scene in the musical in the second act where Raoul and Madame Giry meet, and he's like, who is this guy? What's his deal? And she kind of tells him a little bit about it. And she's like, oh, an architect, this, that. He built, you know, palaces and stuff, and, you know. So it's implied that he could have done that.
They fill in the plot hole Star Wars style by the expanded universe. And the Phantom is like, yo, it's finally time for you to come with me to my rock and bachelor pad. And suddenly the rock and roll music starts up.
Sing once again with me, our strange duet. My power over you grows stronger yet. And though you turn from me...
He lives in the sewers just like the Ninja Turtles.
Yes. But in the sewers, there's also an awesome lake full of candles that don't go out in the water. Magic candles.
Yes. And somehow he got, like, a piano down there, and he's got everything down there.
He's got, like, a pipe organ down there.
Yeah. How do you put that down there?
Okay, look. He's a genius. He figured it out.
He brings it in pieces on his little boat, and he knows how to build them. It's like,
all right, I'm not the hugest fan of the Phantom musical, like, altogether. I, like, love a lot of things about it. And one of the main things I love about it is this scene and how they use doubles so perfectly to, like, give the impression that they're going all over the place. Like, the use of doubling in this musical and, like, dubbed voices over certain things is incredible.
Yeah, it's actually the only pre-recorded song in the musical. Everything else is sung live. Except for a couple of the, like, harder bits. If it's a touring cast and they gotta do, like, 12 shows a week, then if it's like that, then they pre-record some stuff. But this whole song is actually pre-recorded.
I mean, with that final note, I would imagine it had to be.
Hey, Carlotta hits a higher note than that every single night in a different song.
But I've heard other actors that have, like this gentleman who played Raoul for many years, like, made a joke about, like, why does the Phantom have to worry about half his role is pre-recorded? And he's like, you play the role, and then you tell me about it. He's like, 5 years later, damned if he was right, I was exhausted by my first evening.
Well, the thing about the role of the Phantom is that it's a very physical character. Like, you're really acting with your whole body. I've read accounts of actors playing the Phantom. It was like each movement of each of my fingers was calculated. And I had to, like, have that, you know, twisted looking hand and so many things. And it is exhausting. Not just the singing, but, like, the actual physicality of it.
You gotta have all that makeup on, too.
And you apparently have to fight through it because, like, you get huge plosives just from that giant lip extremity, so you're kind of fighting through it to get the pasta point of no return out, as Michael Crawford described.
Yeah, if you sit close enough in, you know, the Majestic or wherever you're watching Phantom, you do see a lot of spit flying.
well, Phantom bring... Yes,
it's part of the
yes.
effect.
The Phantom brings Christine to his lair. He immediately just starts pounding out some Don Juan notes, and he sings a 5-minute song.
Let your darker side give in to the power of the music that I write. The power of the music of the night.
He sings the music of the night because the Phantom is seriously into music. Like, seriously, like, so obsessed with music. He really likes music. And Christine, to him, is a tool to make his music better. And also, you know, he likes her as a person. But mostly, he wants her to sing for him. And that's his deal. And she's kind of conflicted over that.
As anyone would be. Like, I'm sure that Sarah Brightman felt similar ways, like when Andrew Lloyd Webber and her started the relationship, where he kind of fell in love with the voice before he fell in love with the person.
Well, they're not together anymore.
Mostly because of this musical, according to a little bit to Andrew Lloyd Webber's biography.
So the Phantom sings Christine this very sexy song about how awesome music is and how he wants her to be part of his musical expression. And then at the end of the song, he shows her that he has a wax dummy replica of her wearing a wedding dress. And this freaks her out and she faints.
Logical reaction.
He's like, oh man, I shouldn't have shown Christine my real doll. Too soon? First date too soon?
Yeah, you don't really want to bring out the pillow, like, right the first time, you know?
And this is Christina Chan, and she is also in this relationship. All right, so the next morning, the Phantom once again screams out some Don Juan notes on his giant Orion, waking Christine up, which is a little unkind.
Yeah, but now she's intrigued. She's like, okay, this guy was very seductive. I'm really curious about him. I'm kind of into this. I really want to know who he is, what his deal is. And she's actually kind of into it for a minute. So she goes and she rips off his mask.
And she sees it, but we don't.
And then he gets really angry. Because, you know, he's ugly under the mask. He's physically deformed. He was born with a deformed face. And this really makes him angry, and I think it's the fact that he gets so pissed off at her and starts screaming at her and threatening her and calling her names that upsets her a whole lot more than what he actually looks like.
He has very low self-esteem. I mean, if you're going to wear a mask all the time, I mean, you're kind of going to have that, so.
I mean, let's not pretend she wasn't freaked out by the face. Like, the way she describes it to Raoul later shows that she definitely had a visceral reaction to that as well.
Yeah, but the whole, like, violent man yelling at you thing, that's a whole lot scarier than a face.
100%. But she finally reacts to that with, like, kindness, which I think, the giving of the mask back, which I think is kind of the moment the Phantom falls in love with her.
Even though he was so awful to her, she's able to be nice to him and show sympathy for him. And he's like, no one's ever been nice to me before. Oh, my God.
Maybe you shouldn't live in the sewer and terrorize people.
A fantastic actor can sell that moment of falling in love in that moment. And then you've got Gerard Butler.
He's a fantastic something, all right.
So we cut back to the opera house and Joseph Bouquet preys on a bunch of little girls. It's awkward. And explains a Phantom.
Joseph Bouquet is a scene shifter. And he's one of the only people in the opera house who's actually seen the Phantom without his mask on. So he likes talking about it. And you don't talk shit about the Phantom. You can die.
How did he see him without the mask on? Did he get seduced as well?
Walking around backstage one day and the Phantom was like, just hanging out here. Oops.
Was that the moment that he decided, I gotta wear a mask or something?
Well, this obviously isn't in the musical, but in the book, the Phantom doesn't wear a mask regularly. He only gets the mask for Christine, for when he decides, hey, I'm going to meet Christine face to face. I should probably get myself a mask.
Which is fair.
What? Why does he wear a half mask and not a full mask?
Because it's hard to sing and be an actor on stage with a full mask.
That's fair.
It's like, why are there so many scenes in Spider-Man where he takes his mask off? Because you want to see the actor. The actor wants to act.
That's true, but why did they make Spider-Man? That's a better question.
Turn off the dark. Okay, we go to the managers, who all got notes from the Phantom, and for some reason the Phantom's talking a lot more quirky in his letters. Like, maybe he's just like a more funny writer than he is a speaker.
Dear Philman, just a brief reminder. My salary has not been paid. Send it care of the ghost by return of post. PTO. No one likes a debtor, so it's better if my orders are obeyed.
Yeah, I mean, the Phantom does have a real sense of humor in the book. But I feel like when Andrew Lloyd Webber made this musical, he wanted to make it so, like, dark and serious and romantic and sexy. He was like, well, I can't have the Phantom be too funny. Then he's not sexy anymore. So he can be funny when he's not physically in front of you.
Like, I find the notes scene hilarious. Like, it's this and Prima Donna are, like, the 1-2 punch of my favorite moments in this show.
I think I'm going to agree. This is a great part. It's funny.
Everyone likes to talk about how wonderfully poetic Charles Hart's lyrics are, and they are, but people don't give Richard Stilgoe's like very comedic like notes lyrics and Prima Donna the credit it deserves.
Well, it's hard to hear a lot of them because, you know, it's a very operatic right. arrangement where you have a lot of people singing over each other. So unless you've got the libretto in your hand reading along with it, which of course I did as a 12-year-old child because I was that obsessed, you don't know what they're saying.
I had every male part of Prima Donna memorized as a child, and I would scream it along with it and be like, "Orders, warnings, lunit." I love that song.
I don't know what that's like at all.
Jess, this is really unrelatable for everyone else here.
So they get threats, and Carlotta's back, and they're overwhelmed. They're like, "Fine, Carlotta, you get your job back, and everything's going to be good, and Christine's going to play a silent role, because we don't... make demands to terrorists, adhere to the demands of terrorists."
Basically, yeah. They're like, "No, we don't mm-hmm. negotiate with terrorists. We're going to do what we want. Let him do what he will." Even though he said disaster would occur. Mm-hmm. They're like, "Bring it." And then the opera that they do is another
Il
pastiche.
Muto.
And this one, yeah, this is a very Mozart pastiche. So it is one of my favorites because I love this style of opera.
It's so goofy and I love it. I really do love it, and how pink and how gaudy it is. It's so fun.
And it's funny, too, because, like, you know, Mozart operas were funny, so they get to play with that humor as well.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of that scene, Andrew?
Yeah, it was all right.
You were too focused on the man being murdered.
I don't know.
In the rafters.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really the most memorable scene, I don't think, for me anyways.
Well, the Phantom's pissed that Carlotta's singing and Christine's playing a mute, so he makes Carlotta croak like a toad.
Yeah, that was confusing for me. How did he do that?
A ventriloquism. They don't explain this at all. No, but it's...
See, I thought that they were just saying he was magic or something. Or maybe he, like, gave her poison. Like, I don't know.
In some movie versions, yeah, he like put something in her throat spray or something to mess up her voice. But in the original book, it's ventriloquism. And he's a very skilled ventriloquist, so he can make her sound like an actual frog croaking. But of course, it's just the actress going, "Bah!" So.
He's very good at everything he does.
Except he's not good with women.
Well, that's the face, okay?
Yeah, it's not the yelling and screaming or anything. It's
no,
not the threats.
It's because he's ugly.
The jealousy and the demands and the...
The Phantom is full out incel.
Yeah.
Okay. So, the Phantom brutally murders Joseph Bouquet and throws his corpse hanging by his neck onto the stage. And no, it's just an accident, guys. Like, he's all good.
Yes, stagehands die by ropes all the time.
The chandelier incident's the real issue, though.
And Christine and Raoul go to the safest place you would ever go, like the place where there's tons of escape routes, the roof.
I think her logic is that the Phantom lives in the basement, so let's go the opposite way.
That's...
Because clearly he's home right now.
That's fair. That is 100% fair. So she goes to the roof and immediately just starts shit-talking his face.
Can I ever escape? That face, so distorted, deformed, it was hardly a face in that darkness. Darkness.
Yo, he's so ugly.
Yeah, Raoul this whole time is like, there is no Phantom of the Opera. He doesn't exist. This is a hoax. It's not real. And Christine's like, no, man, no, he really exists. He's not a ghost, he's a human, but he's scary and he's dangerous and he really exists. And Raoul's like, well, you don't have to worry about him because you could be with me now. And she's like, we just met yesterday, but sure. Cause
I'm willing to give this
musicals.
One a little bit more credence since they did have the past, like when they were children.
Yeah, you know, when they were 12.
That's more than none at all. That's more than like Julie Jordan and in Carousel.
Yeah. And then they sing a love song.
Yeah. Charles Hart bringing out the mushy there. And then they go off and they're like, oh, let's finish this show. Like, after this whole audience saw a corpse, let me go back on. And the Phantom's like, oh, no, let me drop a chandelier on y'all.
Yeah, because surprise, the Phantom heard everything. And as many times as I have seen the show, there is always someone in the audience who's shocked when he shows up and reveals that he was there all along. Like, you think it would be obvious, but there's always someone who's like, oh, shit, when he comes out of the statue, and they're like, he heard all that? No. What's he going to do now?
She's singing to bring down the chandelier, and he does, but it still bothers me that they were all just going to go and do the show still, after all that.
Hey, that's show business. The show must go on.
Yeah, whatever. Somebody died. It happens every day. Move on.
They didn't have OSHA back then, okay?
That's fair. And that's how we end Act 1. And really, that's a hell of an act closer. Like, the chandelier's down. He's angry. What's going to happen in Act 2?
Does the chandelier falling kill anybody?
It does in the book, but in the musical, it falls and almost kills Christine because she's just kind of standing there staring at it in shock, but Raoul comes and pulls her out of the way.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Wonder how the fan would have felt if he did kill Christine.
In the book, Madame Giry isn't the ballet instructor. She's the person who's in charge of Box 5.
Right.
Which is the Phantom's box, and he gets to watch all the shows from Box 5. And the managers want to fire Madame Giry and hire someone else to run Box 5, and they do. And then the chandelier falls on that person's head and kills them, so Madame Giry gets her job back.
Okay. So 6 months later, during a masquerade ball, the Phantom shows up again. Oh, and Christine and Raoul are engaged.
Yeah, apparently they've just been engaged for 6 months and just hanging out, having a good time. Opera's been good. Everyone's happy. Phantom just disappeared for 6 months, like wallowing in his incel emo angst.
He's writing his fanfic about him and Christine, and they're going to act it out.
So he comes to the masquerade ball dressed fabulously.
As the Red Death.
Yeah.
One of the most awesome costumes in musical theater.
Like, nothing tops it.
And he's like, hey, I wrote this opera. You all are going to perform my opera. Because I said so. Or I'm going to kill my people.
But let me fat shame Pianchi first.
I guess.
So, if he's in the middle of this party and everyone knows that he's the guy that's actually murdered people, why don't they stop him?
I think they're just shocked.
Because he's scary. Yeah, he's big and scary and, you know.
There's like 20 people there.
Half of them are dummies, let's be fair.
Yeah. The musical filled out the staging by putting a bunch of prop dummies in costumes in this party that just kind of stand there, and then all the dancers are dancing around these dummies, so it kind of looks like it's a lot fuller on stage than it is. Because paying actual extra actors and chorus members is expensive, and they want to save money.
Andrew Lloyd Webber, really useful group. They're big on that dollar.
Yeah. Big on that dollar. And you know, the more the show's gone on, the more they've cut the cast. Like, it gets smaller and smaller every year.
All right, I'm looking forward to that. Either way, so Raoul just goes after the Phantom and then fails, obviously, because that's most of what he does. And then he goes to Madame Giry, like, explain everything to me. You know more than you're letting on, woman.
And apparently she does, for some reason. Oh, she's got some, like, dark history where she, like, knew a bit about the Phantom's past, which is convenient. See, in the book, there's this other character that's completely cut out of the musical because he's not white and he's cut out of every version of Phantom. Because, you know, can't have brown
Except
people in our shows.
Except for the Lon Chaney movie. He's kind of in there.
No, but he's in there, but then they rewrote the script and turned him into a French guy. So, like, he's not a Persian character anymore. Like, he's no longer a person of color. He still wears, like, Persian clothes, but it's still a... Like, he's playing a white
Does he
person.
Have a name, like... Like, does he have a name? They call him Daroga in Persian.
Persian guy. Daroga right. means chief of police, and Persian is just his ethnicity. So
That's
he
why he's cut
name.
Out. It makes sense. And I thought Oklahoma was bad.
They combined him with Madame Giry, so now she knows dark secrets about the Phantom's past, and she tells Raoul. Really, she's telling the audience, let's be real. Because it doesn't change anything about what Raoul does. It doesn't make him more sympathetic towards the Phantom or anything.
Wouldn't it have been better if he, like, she told Christine this, like, in a moment of, like, surrogate mother-daughter? Like, here's what you gotta know.
Well, we don't come to this musical for sense.
Fair enough. So they start rehearsing Don Juan, and everyone's like, what is this nonsense?
Yeah, because the Phantom's music is so avant-garde and so ahead of its time and so genius and amazing and musical, as Andrew Lloyd Webber tries to convey through his own music, that the plebeians of Paris just don't get it. You know, nobody gets it because the Phantom's just that awesome.
I think it was just bad.
But they does a magic trick, and the piano starts playing by itself, and everyone's like, oh, we better act on our best behavior. And Christine's like, I'm out. I'm done.
Yeah, because...
And then she goes to the graveyard to visit her father's grave.
Yeah, and she's like, Daddy, I am so confused. What do I do? I don't know what to do. And then the Phantom shows up, and he's like, your dad's dead, but I'm still here. Remember me? I was like your fake dad.
Wandering child, so lost, so helpless, yearning for my guidance.
Angel or father, friend or phantom, who is it?
And she's like, that's true. Maybe it'd be so much easier if I could just go back to that and stop having to think. Because thinking is hard.
Thanks, Daddy.
You know, when you're emotionally traumatized, sometimes you just want to not have to deal with it. But good thing Raoul shows up.
Talks some sense into her. Like, this ain't your dad. Get away from her.
And then he tackles the Phantom.
Nope, the Phantom throws fireballs. And Raoul's like, what?
Well, you see, in the movie version with Gerard Butler, Raoul does try to tackle the Phantom with a sword.
And he kicks his ass, and he, like, is about to kill the Phantom, and Christine's like, no, not like this.
Don't kill that murderer who's tormenting us. Exactly. Don't do it.
If you read the original script for the film that was written, like, 15 years before the film was actually made, so I'm sure it went through some rewrites, in that scene it says... It is important to remember that Raoul and the Phantom are equally matched. And I'm like, bitch, what? Why would they be equally matched?
Raoul would kick the Phantom's ass. The Phantom is not like V for Vendetta sword fighting all by himself in the basement. He's an artist.
But I think he is. Like, he's a genius. He does all these things. He's like perfect at everything, right? And Raoul's just this 21-year-old spoiled brat who's been in the Navy for a little while but probably has no combat training. Why would
I feel like Raoul has like had some fencing training where the Phantom is more like, I can lift rocks.
Phantom smash.
Exactly. So.
But in the actual stage show, there is no sword fight. Raoul just grabs Christine and
that's why the
they
stage show is better. So they decide to put on the Don Juan Triumphant and they perform it, and it's crazy and it looks cool, and it's probably the best designed like set piece in the entire musical.
It's supposed to be a trap to catch the Phantom because they think the Phantom's going to come and sit in box 5 and watch, right? But no, he's not sitting in box 5. He's on stage singing.
He took over Pianji's role.
How does that one...
No, this is staged different ways. Sometimes they stage it where nobody realizes that the Phantom has taken over Pianji's role and is wearing this, like, disguise so you can't tell it's him and singing with Christine until she rips off the disguise and is like, it was him all along. And sometimes it's staged where they don't do that stupid thing and they do know it's him, but they don't know how to deal with it, so they just roll with it.
Do they want a public execution?
They could just tackle him. They could run on stage and tackle him.
Like, they start to do that at one point, but then they're like, no, hold off. Let's see what he's going to do. And then he takes off his ring and, like,
guys.
He proposes to Christine. I don't know. Maybe they're afraid he's going to hurt her or something. So, because they, like, come running on with guns and they're like, no, wait, don't shoot him.
I mean, it all depends on how you stage it. I, like, as you say, like, there's a point, like, in the 25th anniversary, like, concert where she immediately realizes, Pianji doesn't grab me like this. It's the weirdo. Get him off.
One of the most popular stagings is not until way late in the song, she puts her face against his and feels the mask through the cloth against her face. And that's when she realizes. And then she immediately changes how she's singing. She starts singing scared instead of singing in character of the sexy character she was playing. But it's just like, she knows his voice so well. How could she not realize before that? I hate that staging.
I mean, some productions actively have him try to sound like Pianji, which is interesting.
Oh god, when he does the weird Italian accent.
So that goes about as well as you'd expect. She unmasks the Phantom in front of everybody, and he drags her down to the lair. Maybe someone should have tackled him.
How does he keep getting her away from everybody? Why don't they chase after him?
Well, it's supposed to be trapdoors. Some stagings don't have a trapdoor, so he has to just, like, pull her off stage. But she's supposed to go down through a trapdoor because he is this genius architect who built all these secret passages in the opera house and trapdoors and stuff, and, yeah.
And everyone likes him, and everyone thinks he's great. And he's got an 8-pack. So, down in the lair, the Phantom's whining about, like, my face is so ugly, and you're gonna be my bride. Put on my fantasy Weeaboo Christine outfit.
And she's like, no, screw you. She's standing up for herself. She's, like, being strong. And she's like, I don't even care about your face. The fact that you're a jerk who hurts people and yells at me all the time? No.
But that's after she changes into the wedding dress.
Well, I think he's, like, forces her into it.
Just thinking about that makes me cringe.
It's romantic, Jess.
You know how in the sequel it's revealed that they did it? And in the sequel, it's they supposedly she came back after everything and they did it. Well, in the original version of the sequel, they did it during the scene where he forces her into the wedding dress.
Hmm. That implies something else, but okay.
I remember in the early days of the 2004 film, they thought that the Phantom and Christine did it in between the Music of the Night and I Remember, because she woke up without stockings, but she had stockings on.
Well, I could see that. You know, it's a song of seduction. He seduces her. Maybe he actually succeeds.
I mean, all Bill Cosby had to do was sing a song.
Yikes.
Sorry, that's really bad. I apologize for that. That was bad. I wholeheartedly apologize for that. That's terrible.
Anyway, back to the final lair scene. So she tells him off, and she tells him off good, and it, like, actually hits him. And he's like, whoa. But then Raoul shows up, and he's like, never mind. Now I'm going to blackmail you into marrying me by threatening to kill your boyfriend.
With a random lasso that can just dangle indefinitely from the ceiling.
It's a magical lasso.
How is he going to kill the boyfriend with that lasso when he could stand on the ground when he was using it?
I think all he has to do is, like, magically make it elevate, and then the boyfriend's...
So is he actually magic, or is it just, like, tricks and, like, illusions?
It's tricks. He's a magician, you know, like a stage magician. In the book, the magical, or the Punjab lasso, it wasn't a magical lasso, it was just the Punjab lasso, isn't a floating lasso. It's like a whip that he would crack at people, put around their necks, and instantly, like, break their necks with.
That is how you hang people, so.
Yes, yeah, so the magical floating lasso was an invention for the musical, because when you have a spectacular on Broadway, you need effects. You know, the more special effects you have, the more the people like it, so.
In
magic
theory,
show
at
stuff.
Least, like,
hey, the show did very well.
Fair enough. Like, Les Mis did well. They got the giant barricade, Miss Saigon, the helicopter, and all that. Spider-Man didn't do that great, but... So, Christine, like, is like, bro, you are the worst, and decides, like, I wish someone had shown you pity, and gives him a pity kiss, and he is so touched by it.
Yeah. And then he's like, after you have kissed me, I can no longer be a douchebag. So, I'm gonna let you go, and let your boyfriend go. Go, live, be happy. I'm just gonna die of loneliness now, because you've changed my world. And I've realized that being a douchebag is wrong. And it sounds very trite, and in the musical you got to put things fast, but he does have this learning, growing moment, and it's very powerful to see this person who was so awful change. And that's the biggest dynamic thing in Phantom, is that the villain changes. And that's part of why I think Phantom is so popular, because you don't see that a lot.
I mean, he changes a lot in the sequel.
Oh, God.
But he, like, reverts to a childlike state by the end of that song. Like, he's, like, playing Masquerade with the monkey and, like, just in a fetal, like, horrendous, like, sad state. And her pity, like, goes even further when she returns the ring and being like, I'm done with you. Good luck with your life.
It's like she comes back and he's like, wait, did you change your mind? Do you want to stay? Oh, no, you're just giving me you're just rubbing salt in the wound. All right. All right. I'm just going to go cry some more.
Well, those rings aren't cheap, so.
He goes and hides under his blankie of death, and Meg walks on, who we haven't spoken of in this entire submission or synopsis.
All right. Meg exists.
She's more important in the sequel, so we got to set her up here.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So in the musical, Meg is Christine's friend, because it's good when you have a character who spends a lot of time alone to write in a friend for them, so they have someone to talk to, so they're not just like alone all the time or singing to themselves. So now Christine has someone to talk to and sing to, and Meg is her friend.
Yeah, she...
So at the end of the show, Meg comes back.
Mm-hmm. And she pulls off the blankie of death and just finds the mask floating there.
She lifts it up to the light. The music crescendos. The spotlight hones in on the mask. The curtain drops.
Where did he go?
America.
Magic tricks.
He went to America, obviously. And that is one of the most profitable musicals of all time. And truly one of the biggest iconography from that musical is the ending image.
With the mask and the spotlight.
It leaves you like feeling... like both like enchanted and both like kind of like, ooh, what comes next? And then bows come next.
Yeah, it definitely screams sequel, because, you know, nobody dies. They could come back.
There's that one guy.
I mean, none of the main characters die. The love triangle lives
sadly
on.
Sadly enough. And we can all write our own little fan fictions about that, which is the greatest thing about this.
Oh, God, I spent so many years writing Phantom of the Opera fan fictions.
What's...
In my fan fiction, the Phantom dies, and that's it.
That was Gaston LaRue's, too, so...
You know how to appease the people.
What was your fan fiction, Elisa?
Oh, God, I wrote so many. It's still
like,
out there.
What's a general, like, idea of, like, one of yours?
My fan fiction was always dark and creepy. Like, there's always more murder, more darkness... and sometimes the Phantom was at fault, but sometimes he was, like, mixed up in it, too. But I never did the thing where Christine comes back and is like, I loved you after all, and we're going to be together. And I never did the thing where the Phantom finds a new girlfriend.
The Phantom and Meg.
Oh, God. There were a lot of those.
Yikes. I'd ship the Phantom with Madame Giry. Like, that works.
Yes.
A lot of people do ship that.
That feels more right to me than Meg, at least. More right than Christine, even.
I want to retcon it in the guy that's seen the Phantom without his mask, like, prequel. They got together. That's how he saw the Phantom without the mask.
Oh, he's like a bitter ex. I've never seen that done before. That's awesome.
He's just shitposting him all over social media or the opera. This is great.
He's like, yeah, he's ugly.
It's like, have you seen that meme where it's like, well, the guy who sings the You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch song is Tony the Tiger. So what if Tony the Tiger and the Grinch were exes? And it's like, what did the Grinch do to you, Tony? Why are you so mad at him? Why do you sing this mean song?
Hi, guys. Sorry to interrupt you in the middle of the show, but we've come to shill at you.
Oh, boy. Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Just go to audible.com/musicalswithcheese to get started.
Why Audible? Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, and entertainers. This week, we actually have a very controversial selection. We are suggesting that you get The Phantom of the Opera by Gaston Leroux, narrated by Ralph Cosham. Why would we do that? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense for this episode. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese. Again, that's audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese for your free audiobook. So are we ready to talk about what happened after the musical was released on Broadway and in London? Because it kind of blew up all over the place.
Yeah, it went to L.A., and it had a 3-year stint in L.A. It went to Toronto. It was really big there.
It also had the Las Vegas show for a good few years.
Oh, yeah, much later. It's huge in China. And there was a Japan production and German production that were also really big. But in China, it was really huge. The Las Vegas production was a shortened, restaged version. So that was interesting. It wasn't the same exact show, just translated.
And how do they all compare to the original Broadway and London versions? Like, are they all very different productions, or are they all relatively the same?
No, if you saw the national tour before they changed things, they did change the national tour in recent years. But for the first, 20 years of its life, it was the exact same show no matter where you went. And sometimes if you saw the tour at a very great theater in a big city that has a lot of space, it was bigger and grander than Broadway, because Broadway, New York City theaters are kind of tiny in comparison. They don't have the room to sprawl out. So seeing the touring production of Phantom was a real treat.
And out of all the years, who do you think your favorite Phantom and Christine are?
My favorite Christine was Lisa Vroman. Her voice was perfect. She was amazing. And my favorite Phantom was a understudy I saw once. Give me a sec. I'm blanking on his name. My favorite Phantom was an understudy I saw once, Gary Maurer, who's done a lot of different roles, and he's also been the Phantom, but he was understudying at the time. And just, I was sitting front row, which I had done plenty of times, but seeing the emotion in his eyes and just the way he acted the character was so moving. And it's one of the only times I've actually cried when watching the show, because, after you see it 24 times, you start to get desensitized, but it just got to me.
Both great choices. Gary Maurer is incredible, like really incredible. Great choices. I don't know if I could top them, but I love Anna O'Byrne, who was Christine in the Love Never Dies Australian production, but she's an incredible Christine.
She's so gorgeous. I just want to look at her all day. She's so beautiful. And also a good singer, really talented too, but so pretty.
I like that she plays Christine with a lot of resolve, where folks like Sierra Bogus and Sarah Brightman, both wonderful in their own right, tend to play her a little bit more withheld. And Anna O'Byrne is intense, angry. I like my Christine's a little bit more fighty.
Yeah, Lisa Vroman was kind of like that too. She had spunk.
And my favorite Phantoms are John Owen Jones, who has just got the best voice I've ever heard live, and Andrew Varela, who was just a all-around nice guy as well as fantastic performer. I saw him in a touring production a few years ago.
I don't think I have any favorites.
I love Gerard Butler.
Lon Chaney did a very good job.
Lon Chaney did a very good job.
Robert Englund also did a very good job.
Robert Englund did a fantastic job.
Robert Englund might be my phantom, like non-musical phantom. Like that movie takes so many liberties and I still love it.
It's like, what a phantom, but badass. No, more badass. No, more badass.
Then yeah. Bill Nighy.
How many people does he kill? Does he kill like 20 people in that?
Yeah, something at like least. That. Yeah.
Does he melt anyone?
He skins a person alive.
He kind of scalds someone.
Yeah. I want to watch this one.
He boils someone. Does that count?
Can we get a musical version of this?
And he beheaded Carlotta and threw it in like a punch bowl.
No, it's soup. So she's like cooked.
That movie's great. And the devil is a little person.
There are a lot of phantom versions with little people in them. It's like a theme at this point.
Because in the like Herbert Lom version, there is, I want to say it's a rat catcher or something where it's a little person.
Yeah, in the Dario Argento that shall not version, be, one of the rat catchers
that
is a
shall not
person.
Be named.
Well, yeah.
Do we ever have a little phantom? Or
there has not been a little person phantom, sadly enough. Yet.
Not yet.
But see, the thing about the phantom with like Robert Englund and stuff, and especially Andrew Lloyd Webber, is you have these artists, these creators, either filmmakers, musical makers, or something that connect to this book in some way with this phantom character. And they don't look at him and say, he's a scary killer, or he's a villain. They say, this guy is awesome. Look, he's like a genius, and he's powerful, and he's badass, and he's a killer, and he's sexy, and all the women want him. He is just awesome. And they want to romanticize that and elevate that. And with Andrew Lloyd Webber, it was making him sexy. And with Robert Englund, it was making him, like, kick-ass, you know. And they really gravitate towards that. And when I was 12 years old, so did I. Now I can make fun of it, and I see it with self-awareness. But there's definitely that attraction there that keeps bringing people back to trying to make the Phantom cool. Like, so cool.
He does dress very nice, and I like his mask, so I can see it.
So, Andrew, like, did you think the Phantom was cool when you were watching it for the first time?
Not really.
Because you were kind of probably a mature adult who doesn't romanticize awfulness, but
no, yeah, he's kind of like a weirdo who lives in the basement and kills people. Which is kind of why I was curious as to why they kept letting him get away all the time. Like, this person has killed.
So you had difficulty suspending your disbelief for why the Phantom was as powerful as he was able to get away with being.
Well, they didn't give any exclamation for it, because I don't know any of the external material or anything. Just in the musical version I've watched, he just kind of shows up everywhere, and there's not really much explaining it other than that he lives in the sewer.
I wonder if that has something to do with the medium of theater and what you're expected to just accept with that kind of suspension of disbelief and that sort of magicalness of theater that didn't really convey either from the 80s to now or from stage to the DVD version you watched.
I'm not sure. I did think he dressed very nicely, though, and I wish I had some of those suits.
Let's talk about the 2004 movie for a brief period.
must we?
I don't think I've seen this, so I'm not sure.
No, but that's what's going to be interesting here. I want you to react to like all the terrible changes and tell us how you would like why your justification as to why you think those changes were made.
Well, I mean, what did they change?
Okay, so you know how in the musical Christine sort of explains that like, yeah, this angel showed up and just started teaching me how to sing.
Yeah.
And we're both adults, but, you know, he's still like power abusing. But in the movie, they changed it so that she was a child who was living in the opera, because apparently people live in the opera house.
Well, the Phantom does.
And he fell in love with her as an adult when she was a child and kind of groomed her, and she grew up to be 16. So she's still basically a child. And then he did the whole now we're going to fall in love thing.
Well, I mean, I guess it does make him a much worse person.
Yeah.
He's already not that great a person to begin with.
The movie still framed it as romantic. The movie didn't acknowledge that this was creepy and terrible and awful. The movie framed it as super sexy.
Yeah, no. That's, no, not really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that change is obviously from the Robert Unglin version, because Freddy Krueger is a child molester, so.
But see, Christine's an adult in that one, too.
She's also a time traveler, so that movie's weird.
Wait, there's time travel?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the 2004?
No, in the Robert Unglin.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
He can do that. That is one of the more egregious changes, as well as just the performance of the actors. Like, that's...
I mean, it's a movie. They're never going to be as good as professional Broadway stars.
I mean, yeah, that's also fair, but you could have at least tried, you know?
I think Gerard Butler was horribly miscast. I don't care that he's a bad singer. I just think he's the wrong actor for the role.
I think Patrick Wilson would have been a much better Phantom.
He was the guy playing Raoul. I don't even get why they gave him this, like, long 1700s hair when he's supposed to be playing a Victorian guy. Like, he doesn't have hair like that in the musical.
He does have it in the music video with Sarah Brightman and Steve Harley.
Well, that's because it was the 80s and everyone had mullets in the 80s.
Yeah, the movie's just not very good. I don't know how to describe it, like, in the direct perfect ways aside from, like, it's just bad. Oh, and there's... deformity. His deformity is just a sunburn.
Yeah, he's got a teeny tiny mask and an even teenier tiny, like, rash on his face when the mask comes off.
Oh my god.
And that's what he's so angsty about.
And it's almost comedic, like, when he's like, this face the infection that poisons our love. And I'm like, you're still all right.
Well, it's a movie, okay? You can't make somebody too ugly in a movie.
Oh, God forbid.
It's like that Steven Spielberg movie that just came out where the girl is, like, ugly or something. I forget what that was. Ready Player One?
Oh, yeah.
It was, like, a scene where she's, like, super ugly, and then you see her, and she has, like, one freckle or something, and it's like,
she has,
okay,
like, a birthmark or something. It's
yeah.
It's because, like, Hollywood doesn't understand what ugly is.
I think they do. They just don't want to show it.
Well, Hollywood can be afraid to be ugly. Like, Hollywood's afraid to be ugly because they think people don't want to pay money for ugly, so therefore their movies won't make
money. But people love Adam Driver.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
no.
When people actually are ugly in movies, they're like, oh, you're so brave. And then they win mm-hmm. Oscars.
Look at Charlize Theron.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking about, too.
Put me in a movie, I'll be ugly. Let's do it. I don't even have to put on makeup.
The final development that after the musical I do want to talk about is the development of fandom and fan fiction. Like, we've touched about this a little bit, but this is a community I wasn't quite aware of because I didn't really discover Phantom of the Opera until the film came out, sadly
well,
enough.
You and a lot of other mm-hmm. people, and that was a big push for fandom because before the movie came out, the fandom, as it was emerging on the internet, like, internet started getting really popular like late 90s, right? The movie came out 2004. So there were a few years there where there was this thriving Phantom of the Opera community online. For the first time, Phantom fans could connect instead of just having their zines and meetups out in the world. And then the movie came out and there was this influx of new fans. Like, as bad as we say the movie is, there were a lot of people who loved it, who fell in love with Phantom because of it. And then joined these fandom communities, much to the dismay of the purists, but also, you know, more friends. And then all the fan fiction that came out of it was fluff. Everyone wanted to give the Phantom a happy ending. And to those of us who were into the dark and the gothic, that was frustrating.
The Phantom doesn't deserve a happy ending. He's a bad person.
There are a lot of self-published novels. Like, when self-publishing became free on the internet, so many people self-published their fanfic.
Like, what do you think is the most common trend in these fanfictions of the Phantom of the Opera?
Either Eric and Christine get back together. Eric is the Phantom's name. Or Eric finds a new girlfriend who's better than Christine and deserves him more. But one way or another, fans get laid.
Was there ever, like, the blind girl that can't see his face, like, trope used?
Oh, yeah. Actually, that was a trend even before fanfiction. Like, there's some legit published novels out there, like Susan Kay's Phantom and a few others that were actually published by real publishers. And one of them's a Sherlock Holmes Phantom of the Opera crossover. And in it, the Phantom gets a new
Huge.
Blind girlfriend.
Oh, God, that... That's great. But I think the most important fanfic that we need to talk about very briefly is The Phantom of Manhattan.
But that wasn't fanfic. That was Andrew Lloyd Webber saying, I want a sequel to Phantom. And he went out and found a guy, Frederick Forsyth. And he said, hey, you're a well-established mystery writer of historical fiction. Will you write me a sequel to my musical Phantom? And Frederick Forsyth was like, well, let me watch this music first. And he wasn't a fan, you know. And he used the musical, and he also went back to the original novel, and he used elements of that too. But he was a writer for hire. And he did it based on what Andrew Lloyd Webber kind of wanted, but also put in a bunch of his own ideas, of course.
Whose idea was the conversation with Jesus, do you think?
Oh, God. I think that was all Frederick Forsyth, because Andrew Lloyd Webber certainly cut that out of his version. Yeah, like where the Phantom starts worshipping Mammon, the god of gold.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Or what about when Raoul gets his testicles blown off in a duel?
What is happening here?
So in this book, The Phantom of Manhattan, it's a sequel to Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical. And in it, the Phantom, you know, moves to America, is on Coney Island, then becomes this impresario in Manhattan, and then, you know, reunites with Christine. But Christine has a child, and you find out the child has to be the Phantom's child because it couldn't possibly be Raoul's child, because Raoul had an accident one time where he got his nuts shot off.
Oh.
This was published.
Did Raoul not notice that? Like, he's like, oh, shoot, I don't have any testicles.
No, Raoul knows. Raoul is such a nice guy that even though he knows the kid isn't his, he raises it as his own and loves it because, you know, he assumes the Phantom's dead and he loves Christine and he'll be her, you know, beard.
That's fair.
Raoul's a much nicer person in the book.
And there's a line in the book where they're talking about the fact that Raoul will never, like, be able to use his penis, I guess, for sex reasons.
What the fuck?
And they're like, oh no, the poor boy, now he'll never get married or fall in love. And they're like, only a strange and saintly woman could ever love a man who couldn't use his penis. And they're like, well, I guess Christine is a strange and saintly woman, because she's fine with that. Not like they can't.
Yeah, she should have got with the Phantom.
Well, she did, but then he, you know, quote unquote, died, so she thinks. So then she's pregnant, and she's like, Raoul, I'm pregnant with the Phantom's baby, I don't know what to do. And Raoul's like, well, I can't ever get married anyway because I've got this penis problem, so we should get married, and then, you know, both our problems are solved.
I got problems with my pee-pee.
Phantom of the Opera 2, problems with your pee-pee. But the most important thing I wanted to say about the Phantom of Manhattan is Frederick Forsyth retcons away all the Phantom's misdeeds from the musical. Like,
oh yeah!
That is the most...
That's right. He's like, I didn't actually kill Bouquet and throw his body on the stage during a show. I didn't actually kill Pianji.
That just didn't happen.
Nope. Sure didn't. They were just accidents. They actually were accidents. I'm actually such a nice guy.
So is this where Love Never Dies comes from?
Well, yes, because it was where Andrew Lloyd Webber wanted to make a sequel musical. He'd been wanting to for decades, and he needed a book to base it on, so he hired this guy to write this book. And then it didn't happen for a really long time, for reasons, which I can talk about later.
So we'll hold that off, and we'll just put in a giant question mark and a to be continued. All right. Thank you guys for listening. This was a great talk that we had with Elisa. Forgive me. Is your last name Hansen still? Okay. Elisa Hansen, who is a fantastic guest. Elisa, I'm not sure if you've seen any of our other episodes of this show, but the reason why we have the title is because we give a cheese rating at the end of every episode that we do, just to make fun of how arbitrary rating systems are.
I was wondering why my plate of brie hadn't shown up.
So, I'm going to start with Andrew so you get the general premise of the cheese rating. Andrew, what is your cheese rating for The Phantom of the Opera?
I'm never good with these cheese ratings, and I'm the one that made them up. You'd think I'd be good at it.
Is it like you have to assign a type of cheese to it, like the sandwich rating?
Kind of. Last week, I think they chose Gouda because it's just warm and not for everyone, but pretty good. You know, that type of stuff.
I'm going to go with, like, sharp cheddar for no particular reason other than the Phantom dress is very sharp.
He's very sharp. And he has mass appeal. That is a mass appeal cheese.
Yeah, it is a mass appeal cheese, which I think that it does fit kind of well. Jess may have a better cheese in mind, but that's what I'm going to go with. And as far as, like, what I actually think of it, I feel like I didn't get to say too much during this on my thoughts on the show, but I did like it. I definitely can see why it got so big. Yeah, very good music. There's not much else to say.
Well, I guess it is Elisa's turn. What is your overall thoughts on Phantom and your cheese rating?
Oh, maybe like a port wine-infused goat cheese. Something really rich and decadent and creamy and overindulgent that you know is just over the top, but it's delicious anyway and you want it.
I can see that. That's a good pick.
I'm sure you've got mostly positive thoughts about Phantom, but just lay them out for us. What is your thoughts on Phantom of the Opera?
I have a lot of nostalgia for Phantom. It's a very important musical to me. I don't think it's bad. It has this reputation of being like, oh, it's so popular, made so much money for a bad musical. No, I don't think it's bad. I love it. I don't think it's the best musical or the most intelligent musical. I think it's beautiful and romantic, and I think it did everything that Andrew Lloyd Webber wanted it to do, and that is good enough for me.
Well, that's fair. Well, yes, it is.
It's very cheesy.
My cheese rating is Aradel, which is the cheese with, like, the little mask around it, so.
Aww.
All right, so Phantom of the Opera, not my favorite musical, but the things it does so well that it's hard to hate against it. Like, you can't just start talking about the faults about Phantom of the Opera without sounding like an asshole, because it's like, but the stuff it does is so great.
And for the mid-80s, like, you can't compare it to stuff that exists now.
Is good.
Like, without it, we wouldn't have an entire subgenre of gothic, like, musical theater. And that is wonderful. And
hell yeah.
I think it validates its existence just because of what it inspired.
I'm still looking forward to the Dark Universe version of this, though. Like, when that comes out, I'm hyped.
Someone's got to tell him.
So hyped.
Someone's got to tell him.
Like, they say the Dark Universe is dead, but they're still making individual movies? So
hey,
maybe if
hey,
they're not
love
shared
never
universe.
Dies, okay?
Except when it
all
does.
Right, thank you guys for joining us. Please rate us and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. Actually, my bad. There was one thing I gotta do. I promised to. We gotta give out an award, Andrew. I apologize.
Oh, who are we awarding?
Elisa. Do you mind doing me a favor? Do you mind giving me a number between 1 and 10 so this is, like, completely unbiased?
5.
Apple iTunes. Reviewer Classic Sonnets (parentheses Steph L), you are our winner of a $25 Amazon gift card. So
please send us an email at musicaltheaterlives@gmail.com,
and we'll set you up with that $25 Amazon gift card for reviewing us on iTunes. Thank you for doing that. We're gonna have another one of those review raffles coming up pretty soon. So keep reviewing us on iTunes. We're on Twitter at Cheesy Musicals. Our Instagram is Musicals with Cheese. Our YouTube page is Musical Theater Lives, and our title card is created by Jolene Casco. Her Instagram is Jolene Casco. Elisa, I know you've got tons of stuff you want to promote. Go on and promote.
You know what you could spend your Amazon gift card on? My book. It's only $4.99 on Kindle. My book is called The Company of Death. It is on Amazon or where else you want to buy. My Twitter is Elisa in Time, like Elisa in Space, except in time. And my YouTube channel is Maven of the Eventide, or if you just Google vampire reviews, I'm the first thing that comes up.
And my favorite video of hers is the Vampire Academy video, so that would be my recommendation. All right, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week on Musicals with Cheese.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suffs celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.